You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 28, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Wilfred Codrington, assistant professor of law at Brooklyn Law School, on Joe Biden's Supreme Court pick. Also on the program today, Ukrainian and Russian delegations meet on the Belarusian border. No progress as war rages. Meanwhile, Putin puts nuke deterrent forces on high alert.
Not funny.
Not funny. One imagines they're always on high alert, but he makes a point of telling people about it. U.S. and Europe remove some of Russian banks from the SWIFT global banking network. Putin apparently promised Macron he'll stop strikes against civilian targets. So we got that going for us. Supreme Court to hear a case today. It could very well eviscerate the EPA and begin the total assault on our regulatory state. Absentee ballot rejections spike in Texas primaries based on its new voting law. First Capitol riot defendant trial set to open in D.C. today. The CDC eases mask guidance. Biden's State of the Union will be mask optional. New research points to Wuhan wet market as the genesis of COVID-19. Trump wins the CPAC straw poll. And lastly, Freedom Convoy flames out in the dead of night. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. I am back and here throughout that brief vacation time I had. Anything? Did anything happen, Emma?
Some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, you got to take this week off, you know, didn't get any of the heat that perhaps Matt and was directed towards Matt and myself. And
you guys take some heat?
I would say.
Well,
so now you get to come in clear-headed with a tan.
Yeah, people didn't like my Love is Blind take.
Yeah. Well, I am. I'm midway through that. I'm almost done. Oh man, it's even better this season.
I don't even know what that means.
Okay.
But I can tell you. I can assure you that the heat that I took in the midst of Disney World, you know, well, we'll talk more about that. If there wasn't a war raging right now, I probably would come back and talk a little bit about the nightmare that Disney was. But it seems to obviously pale in comparison. And but I obviously was following things to the extent that I could, being knee deep in 24/7.
Tomorrowland.
With two children.
Yeah.
And Tomorrowland, yes.
You seem to have, you're tan, you're bronzed.
I went into a tanning booth.
Oh, yeah. That's how you got away with secretly being at CPAC.
Right.
Inside all the time.
Right. I don't know that it occurred to me to head over there.
Yeah.
Somebody suggested to me, like, you know, you could write this whole thing off as a business trip if you walked over there. I'm like,
all you gotta do is leave your kids unattended and go to sit back.
Exactly.
Gotta do it, kids.
Exactly. I will get to the Disney stuff, after a while. and maybe not today, but sometime in the future. Just want to, well, you know, let's play these clips, because one of the things that I found interesting, and this is, I want to be clear here that there's a lot of reasons one could point to as to why what's happening with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, that it could resonate with people in Europe and across the world in a different way than in other conflicts, because Europe is the site of the last two world wars, the only two world wars that we've had. Russia, former superpower, arguably, you know, at least militarily, still one of the superpowers, I guess. And there's a lot of, you know, sort of and nuclear weapons. Yeah. I mean, and so there's a lot of reason why this conflict would get more attention than, say, the Saudis and our involvement in that assault on Yemen, which, you know, is going to end up killing and has killed. We don't know where this is going with Russia and Ukraine, but thousands upon thousands of people. In Afghanistan, Joe Biden just, you know, taking that money, and it's no guarantee that that $7 billion had it been allowed to flow back to the Taliban would alleviate any or all of the suffering in Afghanistan, although you could imagine it would alleviate some. There are millions of people in Afghanistan who are looking at potential starvation right now, right now. And so there's no, you know, these are apples and oranges things, and it's not to take away from what's going on in Ukraine. But it's just something to be aware of, and I think we're going to talk about this more going forward. And there's some theories out there as to what's going on with that. But it has been part of the reason why there's so much more attention being paid. And again, I don't think it's all the reason, and I don't think it's maybe not even the majority. Who knows how to assess these things? But it's because of who is being invaded.
Yeah.
And by who, I mean, well, I'll let this guy, CBS News foreign correspondent Charlie D'Agata, who has apologized for this, but nevertheless, it's revealing. It's not, this is not about Charles D'Agata or whatever the guy's name is.
Yeah, right.
We've got more of these clips. It's really, in many respects, about all of us. But here it is.
Now with the Russians marching in, it's changed the calculus entirely. Tens of thousands of people have tried to flee the city. There will be many more. People are hiding out in bomb shelters. But this isn't a place, with all due respect, you know, like Iraq or Afghanistan, that has seen conflict raging for decades. You know, this is a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose those words carefully too, city where you wouldn't expect that or hope that it's going to happen. So it's partly human nature, but they are not in denial.
All right, let's just be clear here. I mean, part of the reason why Iraq had conflict for decades was because we started bombing and invading them at one point. Now, of course, there was also the Iran war prior to that, and the war with Kuwait, you know, prior to that.
But the United States, like, deliberately targeted Iraq's water purification and infrastructure systems, and knowing it would spread disease. And so, you know, that might have contributed to the lack of civilization that he's referencing.
Right.
But it's about the color of people's skin, let's be real.
And you know, it's not like Ukraine has not seen any type of war that is happening. The Eastern Front of Ukraine, there's been ongoing conflict since 2014. I mean, so, but yes, it is about race. It is about, you know, some notion of economic development, I guess. And you know, so these are people who look like us in buildings that look like ours.
You see the Christian thing get thrown around too.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, here's another. I mean, it's not just about Charlie Delgado, whatever his name is. Here's NBC News correspondent Kelly Cobiella. Yeah. I don't know.
Just to put it bluntly, these are not refugees from Syria. These are refugees from neighboring Ukraine. And that, quite frankly, is part of it. These are Christians, they're white, they're very similar to people, many people who live in Poland.
Whoa.
And look, there is an aspect of human nature where it's like, oh my gosh, you know, my kid wears clothes just like that and has that same, whatever it is, the Chatty Cathy doll or whatever, you know, and so people sort of relate to it more. But it is pretty stunning when you contemplate it. And again, there are a lot of other factors associated with this. There's nukes involved in this. There's our longtime rival from the Cold War. But when you when you look at it just in terms of like sheer human misery, we're not at the level of where we are in Yemen or in Afghanistan or in Iraq or in Syria. I could keep going on in Libya. Play this example of it. Here's Al Jazeera's Peter Dobby.
The population, as you're talking to us, Matthew, we're playing in the latest pictures of some of the refugees trying to get on trains or trying to get out of Ukraine. And what's compelling is just looking at them, the way they're dressed. These are prosperous. I'm looking to use the expression. These are prosperous middle-class people. These are not obviously refugees trying to get away from areas in the Middle East that are still in a big state of war. These are not people trying to get away from areas in North Africa. They look like any European family that you would live next door to.
Fuck off.
Well, that was somebody else who was watching that. But the sentiment, I think, is appropriate. I got news for you. They're refugees.
I mean,
they're refugees. Like, they're not refugees from the Middle East or from Africa, but they're refugees.
There were some middle class refugees and all those other places as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
What does middle class mean in this context?
Prosperous.
Right.
I mean, there's an understanding.
No, what middle class in this instance means white.
Yes. Average. Somebody I can relate to. Somebody who would be next door to you.
But there was. But Matt's point stands. I mean, you had 4 million people displaced in the Iraq war, for instance. 2 million internally, 2 externally. These are middle-class people. These are doctors. These are lawyers. These are bus drivers. These are teachers. These are laborers. These are, shopkeepers and clerks who work at the shops. And there's a whole, from an economic standpoint, it's the full mix. You don't get to decide.
Well, so Branko Marketic, over the weekend, I was just reminded of this. There was a fake news clip going around. Well, it wasn't fake news. It was a video of a young Palestinian girl confronting an Israeli soldier. And it was being circulated, even though it's in like the arid, hot area, and saying that this was what was happening in Ukraine, and a lot of people got fooled. And the response is entirely different in that context, as opposed to, you know, the global solidarity, which is helpful that we're seeing, especially from the West. But it does demonstrate the gaps in our empathy when it comes to certain people. It's instructive. And it's, of course, you know, widespread over foreign correspondent media as well.
There was a tweet thread, and we're going to try and get her on over the next week or so. Kimberly Sankt, Julian Varnin. She's a PhD student at UPenn, but she's studying in a specific discipline of history. And the brief thread was about how in 2014, Ukrainians were not considered Europeans. or at least Western Europeans. They were still considered Eastern Europeans. And I, you know, I don't know if you remember, Matt, but we did not. I mean, we covered the Crimea a little bit, and I remember John McCain saying, bah, 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 we, you know, bomb, 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 which is his usual refrain at that time before he died. And, but there was certainly not this outpouring of concern and sentiment, and it is a, it's very instructive to see both how a people move from one category of who they are into another category of who they are as perceived by the Western world, you know, the rich Northern Hemisphere Western world, white world, largely. And I mean, that aspect is interesting. And then also how once you're included in that basket, you're the perspective that people have about your suffering. You know, when we talk about white supremacy and we talk about the value gap that Eddie, oh gosh, professor from Princeton, Eddie Gloud wrote about the value gap in the way that we value lives. Like this is, you couldn't have a better illustration of it.
And how whiteness is a social construct and like largely tied to economic prosperity and being at the top of the pyramid in capitalism.
I think there's a lot of people that see like the previous conflicts like Iraq and say like, no, doctors couldn't have been put out by that. It must have been all just like rabble.
Right, yeah. Right. And it makes you wonder also how did they go from 2014 to now? What were the factors that were involved in that, essentially that, that transfiguration from not really quite white to white, not quite really, you know, like Western European to Western European. Not quite developed to developed. And I, you know, in the eyes of those who are constructing this, and again, I want to make it clear, like, this is not to say you should not have, I mean, what's going on over there is horrible, but I think it's important to just sort of be conscious of this. And I would be curious as to how that transfiguration changed. Because, you know, we're entering into a moment now where, and I think there's arguments about NATO expansion that I think have value. I think there's a lot of, you know, I don't know how rational an actor Putin is, but what's clear is there were certain assumptions that he made that were wrong. Things may have followed logically from that afterwards. But, you know, it's not like in the early aughts when, or in the 90s rather, when the idea of expanding NATO was up, there was a lot of people, some hawks, you know, Gary Hutz, Sam Nunn, who was a pretty hawkish guy, Democrat from Georgia, who were saying we should not expand NATO because we have an equilibrium. We should maintain it. And, but there are others, and, you know, I mean, so there's a lot of things that are going on in terms of these factors here. And I don't necessarily have any answers, but it's really more about exploring some of these questions and hoping that, you know, there is some very quick end to this, because you can see the possibility of things escalating. And
well, I mean, Putin's demands, it's starting to feel that way, because the demands are that I want a denazification of the Ukrainian state, demilitarization, and ensuring a neutral status of Ukraine, which essentially means I want this to be Belarus for me. I want a neutral, aka I think pro-Russian leader and no more Zelensky. That's what it's starting to seem like.
Oh, I think that's what he wanted to. I think he wanted to do in the first place. Yeah. And it didn't work out that way. And, you know, who knows if, I guess what I'm worried about on some level is like, this is, you don't know, there's no way to know. Is Putin at this point, would he welcome an exit ramp where he doesn't look like he's losing face? Does NATO at this point say like, oh, wait a second, maybe this guy's now back-heeled. Maybe we escalate this a little bit, and this is a way of getting Putin off the world stage. I mean, both of those things are terrifying. So,
and it's complicated too, that right now Saudi Arabia has developed a relationship, as was reported by Ken Klippenstein, and they're driving up oil prices with Russia, and there's China in the wings that, you know, they're at least neutral on Russia's aggression right now. So,
all right. Going to take get a couple of sponsors, and then, we will be talking to, Professor Wilford Codrington about Joe Biden's pick, which was also I was a little worried about that.
Yeah, that was good news.
Pretty good news. Ketanji Brown Jackson is the nominee. We will talk to the professor about that. Just a show note tonight at about, I think it's about 7:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I will be on the Twitch show Log Off Already.
Wow.
Yeah. James Cole Cash.
That's fun.
And so I'll be on there for about 45 minutes. A long time coming. He asked me to do it a long time ago. And of course I lost emails and I got whatever, but pretty excited to do that. And apparently it's his birthday too. So folks, time is money. You don't have to waste either. With repeated trips to the post office. Stamps.com lets you print official postage right from your computer, saves you money in the process, and you can spend less time at the post office, more time in your office or your apartment, or you can do this 24/7. And what happens? Your customers are happy. For more than 20 years, Stamps.com has been an indispensable to over 1 million businesses. And with Stamps.com, you get discounts you can't find anywhere else, like 40% off U.S. Postal Service rates and 76% off of UPS. Doesn't matter whether you're in office sending invoices. Doesn't matter whether you got an Etsy shop or you're sending merch from your podcast or, I don't know, you're a Matthew Film guy and you got your...
DVDs to send out.
Your DVDs to send out, or you got at one of those eBay shops. You can be a full-blown warehouse shipping out orders. Stamps.com is going to make your life easier. You get access to all the post office and UPS shipping services you need right from your computer. You just need a computer and a standard printer. That's it. You can print your own postage. U.S. Postal, like stamps. A functional equivalent of a stamp.
Right.
That's pretty exciting. And you can do it at 5 a.m. You're like, you know what? I can't sleep. I'm going to send off a couple of DVDs. Boom. You do it. Stamps.com is basically what got me through the early stage of this podcast when I was sending out DVDs as part of the membership.
Mm.
And, that was the first couple of years back in the day, back when, you know, my fingers were nimble. Not so much today. I can't pack it. I had Myla at one point stuff envelopes.
Oh, really?
Yep. I paid her money. But you can right now, you can stop overpaying for shipping with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code Majority Report, and they're going to give you a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale. There's no long-term commitments, no contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, enter the code Majority Report. Also, you know my watchwords, the best time to look for someone to hire is when you don't need to hire somebody. So you're not in a full-on panic about it.
Develop a bank.
Yeah. According to the latest research, 90% of employers plan to make enhancing the employee experience a top priority in 2022. I can tell you, I was just down in Disney and understaffed.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff wasn't up. No. Fully booked, understaffed. And there was a lot of people I was around who were like murmuring. They didn't like it. They did not like it. So it's important you have a happy workplace. It's key to attracting and keeping great employees. You know, frankly, you allow for unions, and maybe I shouldn't be saying that on the ad thing, but you allow people to unionize.
Yeah.
You give people to, I don't know, snacks. That's important too.
Mm-hmm. For morale.
But obviously better wages.
Not that we have snacks here, but
healthcare. Corey, what are you talking about?
Okay. Sorry.
Well, we got a water cooler.
Yeah.
That, what'd you say that raised?
Snack on water.
Yeah. Well, pretty soon we're going to have bread.
Liquid IV is a solid before you put it in the water.
Yeah. But if you need to add more employees to your team, there's ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's matching technology helps you find the right people for your roles fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology. It finds and matches the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents these candidates to you. You can easily review these recommended candidates and you invite your top choices and you invite them to apply to your job, which of course encourages them to apply faster. That's how we got Brendan, old Brendan that we call him now. Then we got Bradley through Brendan. I mean, that's the way it works, folks. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective. 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. I did. We had a lot of really good candidates. Brendan was just like made in a test tube for this job.
Right.
Find the right employees for your workplace with ZipRecruiter. You can try for free at this exclusive web address. Ready? ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's exclusive to us. ZipRecruiter.com/MAJORITY. ZipRecruiter is the smartest way to hire. And I wanted to do a shout out to my favorite sponsor, Sunset Lake Sebade. Sunset Lake Sebade. If you use the code LEFTISBEST, you get 20% off. Why? Because for people who have listened to the show for a long time, you know that for me, sun is like kryptonite. And when I first get my first blast of sun, like when I take a trip like this, which doesn't happen that often.
You get burned?
No, I don't get burned. And in the summer, the first like couple of weeks of sun, I get eczema.
Oh, okay. So you use the salve.
And bingo bango, like clockwork. I know this is sort of gross, but right there, I got it. Right under my arms.
Yeah.
And right under my forearm.
New HD. It's you can really show off Sam's eczema.
And good. I travel now with the salve with the arnica, and it does 2 things. One, it stops the intense, insane itching. Mm. Now, listen, this is not what it's supposed to be used for. It's supposed to be used for muscles.
But it works for you.
But I have an absence of that. What I do have is is the eczema. And then it begins to sort of like, I'm not going to get too detailed, but it separates and it starts to like calm down. I mean, it takes a while.
We would not want you to get too detailed after you showed it on air.
Right.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is sunsetlakesebade.com. They've got tinctures. They've got pre-rolls, which also, I have to say, was very important to me during the vacation to Disney. Mm. Dad would take a walk. I'll be back in 15 minutes. And I enjoyed one of the pre-rolls just to chill because my kids were driving me crazy.
Sam in Central Florida with a CBD pre-roll.
There you go. But they have the pre-rolls, they have the keef, they have the flowers. They also have...
The tincture is my favorite. I used it last night because I wanted...
Help you sleep.
I got up early for a workout, wanted to make sure I got a good sleep. It worked.
It works big. And they have a couple of flavors on that, citrus, original, and mint. They also have fudge with sebade. They have coffee with sebade. They have hand lotion, hemp hand lotion, all of their products. You can find out what's inside it by checking on their website. They have a third-party analysis of it. Great company, great business practices, and they chose the coupon code LEFTISBEST for 20% off. Check it out now. All right. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Wilford Codrington, assistant professor of law at Brooklyn Law School, to talk about Ketanji Brown Jackson, who has been nominated to the Supreme Court. We are back, Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report, and joining us, Wilford Codrington. He is an assistant professor of law at Brooklyn Law School. Thanks so much for joining us, Wilford. I'm here, obviously, with Emma Vigeland.
Thank you, Sam and Emma, for having me.
All right, so it's official as of, I guess,
Friday.
That Ketanji Brown Jackson is Joe Biden's nominee. There were two other, I think, potential nominees that were at least getting most of the attention. Give us a sense of where Ketanji Brown Jackson is. Let's just look at her record in a vacuum, and then let's put it in the context of the Supreme Court.
Sure. So, and just to mention, it seemed like the two other top contenders were Judge Childs, who comes from a federal district court in South Carolina, and Justice Leandra Kruger, who has an appellate background and is a state Supreme Court justice for California. Judge Ketanji Jackson, I would have to say I thought was the easy choice. In terms of her background, she graduated with this sort of Tony prestigious background that you would see for other justices on the Supreme Court. So she went to Harvard for undergrad, graduated with honors, went to Harvard for law school, graduated with honors, was on the Law Review as an editor. From there, she served in three prestigious federal clerkships, including for the Supreme Court, clerking for the justice who she would replace. She worked in the private sector and the public sector. She'll be the first public defender to ever serve in the position of Supreme Court justice. Notably, Thurgood Marshall was a defense attorney, but he was never a public defender. She worked at the U.S. Sentencing Commission for nearly 5 years. She was the vice chair of that, that agency. That agency notably handles the sort of recommendations for federal sentencing guidelines. She was a federal trial court judge for 8 years, an appellate judge for about a year, and now being recommended here. So, you know, in terms of what she's done, in many regards, she looks like a very sort of the archetypal Supreme Court justice nominee. But in many regards, she's also very different. She has these elements that make her very different from other justices and will bring a life of experience and professional and otherwise with her to the bench.
In terms of basically what you're saying is, like, if you look at on paper, the pedigree is fairly typical. I mean, and to some extent, I mean, almost problematically so, right? I mean, like, people are starting to get the idea that maybe we shouldn't just have justices from Harvard and Yale on the bench. But like you say, would she be the first public defender? She was a public defender, my understanding, for about 2.5 years. And she did so because she was on the sentencing committee or commission and felt that she was just looking at numbers, had no idea how the system actually worked in practice. She became a public defender. And then at one point in DC, and then at one point was, took the assignment to defend people in Guantanamo Bay as well.
Right. And so, look, I think you're going to have people try to tear apart different elements of her resume for one reason or another. But it's laughable to say, look, we have this dual Ivy graduate, and therefore that's problematic for the Supreme Court. When you look at the composition of the court in general, there are so many dual Ivy graduates. Now, there's one who is not, Justice Barrett, but, like, that's the first in a really long time. And, you know, to be honest, one of the sort of loudest voices for this was Senator Graham, who was pushing for Judge Childs. So there was a motivation behind there, right? But to me, to kind of flip that and say you are too qualified or something like that doesn't really pass the laugh test. In terms of her work leaving the Sentencing Commission to become a public defender, that, I think, speaks volumes of not only about her intellectual curiosity, but her commitment to actually marrying the practice of law with something that was sort of a little bit more theoretical and sort of a little bit more detached from the way that it impacts people's everyday lives. And so she was working at the Sentencing Commission and sort of, you know, was instituting these policies without having that background to say, like, how this is going to impact the people who are the subject of the Sentencing Commission. So I think that is very laudable. And it's rare to have people who have that sort of in the weeds, pragmatic and practical experience that they can sort of implement at the highest levels.
And when, I'm sorry, I don't mean to.
No,
but
okay.
When did she do that? I mean, and the reason why I ask is it became clear, I mean, certainly during the Obama administration, but I would imagine back even in the Clinton administration, that and certainly during the Bush administration, that there was a very rigid path that you took to get to the Supreme Court. And to make the decision to become a public defender, it seems to me, even though, like, it was quite clear from an early age that she wanted if you're heading to be a judge and you're clerking for a Supreme Court judge, the percentage of those people who want to be a Supreme Court judge is pretty high. To make that decision to do public defending, where, again, there's no model for someone who's a public defender to become a Supreme Court justice. That, to me, I find it even particularly impressive and interesting, I guess, that she made that decision, despite the fact that she couldn't have said, this is what's going to lock me in for something like that.
Right. And I think that that is, again, that's laudable, because somebody in her possession with her credentials and sort of blazing the paths that she did, you know, that could have sort of taken her on a very different path. And it shows that she wasn't on this sort of straight and narrow, and there were other things driving her. So you talk about the climate in which she sort of left the sentencing commission. At the time, she was counsel, so she was a staffer to the commission, and then went to go take the position as a public defender. The climate was very much a sort of a more conservative, tough on crime sort of approach. And they sort of took these steps ultimately when she was back there to liberalize the sentencing commission guidelines, particularly for the crack cocaine disparity. So, you know, like, it shows that she wasn't clipping her wings by taking these professional opportunities that she thought useful, interesting, important, and impactful, because she kind of had her eyes always set on the prize for a Supreme Court position.
Well, so, I mean, she clearly stuck out to me as the best of those three finalists based on what you're saying here. I mean, like, the Lindsey Graham argument was in such bad faith, right? It was like the idea, oh, Lindsey Graham doesn't care, has a real strong opinion about Ivy League graduates being on the Supreme Court when he had just confirmed Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, who not only went to Ivy League schools, went to the same damn high school. So, like, let this spare me with that argument. But the Gitmo thing really sticks out to me, because that seems particularly risky. If you're up for a Supreme Court nomination, Republicans might balk at that. You know, there's already the groundwork being laid. Oh, she defended terrorists. Can you talk a little bit more about her work there? Because that was, for me, the thing that was my favorite part of her resume that I read.
Look, we live in a system where everybody is entitled to defense attorney, and it doesn't matter who you are. Some of the most incorrigible, or people accused of the most incorrigible crimes, are still afforded an attorney. And so for her to take that position, I think, in coming as an attorney, it is one of these things that, sure, it probably presents some difficulties for you, but also professionally, you're guided by this lodestar that everybody deserves this. And so, you know, this wasn't a problem before when she was nominated and confirmed to become a district judge. It was not a problem when she was nominated and confirmed to become an appellate judge. And now it just becomes the biggest problem in the world. I mean, it is... problematic to raise this as a red flag when this has never been a red flag. And it's even more problematic to sort of raise this as a red flag when it is one of the most fundamental pillars of our criminal justice law center. So irrespective of who her defendants were at the time, she was doing the job, the highest calling of a professional in the legal profession.
And we should, I think, you know, it's important to be clear here, because sometimes people can make this a category error. There is a difference between the import and the notion of a right to defense in a criminal trial, in terms of the way that reflects on lawyers, versus the right of a corporation
to represent ExxonMobil.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Right. I mean, because defense within a criminal defense case is a constitutional question, as opposed to, like, you're not enhancing the system in any way. You're not protecting the system. Well, maybe you are, but not the constitutional system. If you are representing some corporation who, or going in and arguing in front of the Supreme Court that slave labor is okay, you know, by Nestle in another country or something like that. I mean, I just want to put a fine point on that, because sometimes those two ideas get conflated.
Yeah, and so that's it's just, it is ironic that, of the scores, we're now, I guess we will be at 115 of Supreme Court justices, so many of them came from the corporate litigation practice, right? They just represented massive corporations. And really, that is not what our system is supposed to be about. about. And certainly when we're talking about sort of criminal rights, right, we're looking at the Bill of Rights and the criminal rights procedural protections as protecting individuals, and particularly discrete individuals who are unpopular, right? And those are the people who need the most. And to be a defendant who got the sort of caliber of representation that somebody would have gotten from then Attorney Jackson, you know, that person would have been fortunate. And really, that would have been an outlier, because that's not the sort of representation that most criminal defendants get in our system. So again, she's doing her professional job. She's probably doing it to the highest standards of the profession. And really, that should not be a ding against her.
What, where is she relative to Breyer's, right? I mean, to the extent that we can, so let's talk about her in the context of the Supreme Court, you know, which involves also, to what extent do we know how she will function? It's one thing to be a trial court judge, but as an appellate judge, you get a sense of how, of the legal, her approach to legal doctrine, I guess, because in a functional manner, it's probably not going to make that, in terms of like where she votes, it's not going to make that much of a difference, right? In terms of Breyer and her, at least in, you know, in the current makeup of the court. So what becomes important, it seems to me, what kind of justice will she be in terms of providing toeholds for 20 years down the road? When she's like, I guess she'll be what in? Well, she'll be 70, 71, which would still put her, you know, like she'll still be, you know, a fairly young justice as far as they goes. But maybe 20 years from now, maybe less, there'll be an opportunity to begin to unwind some of the stuff that I think this court is about to embark upon. Is she going to be the type of judge who's going to put like those toe holds there? What are the type of decisions or dissents, probably more likely, will she write? Do you have a sense of that?
Yeah, so I think one thing to note is that she's only been an appellate lawyer, appellate judge for about a year. So we don't really have a sense of what her sort of appellate reasoning would look like, but we do have 8 years of her writings on the bench, nearly 600 opinions as a district judge. And from what we can tell from those, she's very methodical. She's been reversed very few times at any point in time. She's been affirmed by a unanimous Supreme Court on one of her decisions where she was reversed at the appellate level. And so she's very careful, methodical, and approaches the law very soberly. But you know, again, when you get to the Supreme Court, you are the last stop in the land in terms of our judicial hierarchy. And so we'll see what it looks like. But I do think that it will be interesting. Yes, she's not going to change the outcome, and particularly of some of the most decisive issues. She will be in a sort of 6-3 minority replacing her judge. She may have different views. It seems that she is somewhat of a pragmatist and a consensus builder like her former boss. But I think it would be interesting to see her operate in a couple different outcomes. So one, there's a very important abortion case that's up at the court this year, will be decided this year. She will not be on the bench at that time, but the implications that will reverberate throughout the court system. And who knows, we will be seeing more abortion cases and reproductive rights cases. I think the way that she operates with two other women in the dissent and see what that looks over time will just be fascinating for an issue where she'll be pitted up against mostly men. I think it would be another interesting thing to see her sort of go toe-to-toe with Justice Thomas. And I say this as her being the other Black justice. And, you know, she will be the other Black justice coming from a state that was the former Confederacy. She will have lived and grown up in the post-civil rights era. Her parents grew up in the segregated South. So it's a very different circumstance, but I think she comes with a perspective. And so when you get these important cases that come up, for example, you'll have the affirmative action case that comes up to the Supreme Court. What does her decision and her views on the issue look like compared to his? And we know that most on the right take their sort of pecking orders or their views from Clarence Thomas, who really, when you think about it, does not reflect where the majority of the Black America is on that issue. When we look at what the Supreme Court does in voting rights area, the Supreme Court just basically overstayed at least a district court decision in Alabama about the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And they said that basically there was an unconstitutional, or there was a Section 2 violation for a gerrymander based on race. When Clarence Thomas has been actively trying to thwart Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act for decades now. So when she comes in, I'm curious what her perspective is going to be. Another justice coming from the stalwart South, looking at what voting and sort of Voting Rights Act was meant to do to protect Black people. I think she will make her voice very clear over time. I think like any other justice, she will probably come in taking baby steps and learning the ropes. But I think you're right. You know, she'll be on there potentially for 2-3 decades and will be able to like start setting some bread. Sowing some breadcrumbs and laying a path for where she wants to see the court go over time.
Can we just take a break and say how effed up it is that we are having to sort of like read these tea leaves on a person coming to the Supreme Court and guess like where she's going to be, you know, what she's going to do because we have a system where there are 9 people who can fundamentally change the relationship between government and the people. Like just, I mean, you mentioned Thomas has been after Section 2. Roberts was after Section 5 for decades, literally was doing that during the Reagan administration, was like, let's do this. Let's get rid of this stuff. And today, the court is, and maybe you can talk about this because it strikes at the heart of our regulatory state. It's been something that we've been talking about on this program for years. The non-delegation principle and the Chevron doctrine are all implicated, I think, in this case with the EPA. And in terms of real impact, it's like how much mercury are we going to breathe? How much can we really constrain global warming? Will you talk about that dynamic in this case that we're hearing today? And I guess just the idea that like, well, hopefully this one of these 9 Supreme Court justices that maybe we'll get on will decide like maybe government should be able to regulate poison stuff.
Right. And so I think there's two questions you're marrying there. One is that we live in the system of judicial supremacy. And the fact, like when we talk about, you know, her, it being a problem that she went to the Ivy League and not being reflective of the United States. Well, nobody on that court is really reflective of the United States in that regard, right? The fact that you have 9 people who can determine what the Constitution says, irrespective of how the rest of us feel, irrespective of how the other branches think about, you know, that's a lot of power. And so this becomes such a monumental decision with any president that makes this choice. So we have to set that aside because, you know, there's real questions about what that means. But then you also talked about other doctrine that are sort of being picked at right now. You mentioned first when I mentioned the VRA, but you mentioned rightly that, you know, since Chief Justice John Roberts was a baby attorney, he was going after that in the Reagan years. And now this non-delegation principle, which is actually I'm teaching to my con law students today. And the idea is how much authority we should be granting administrative agencies to make decisions about the health and well-being of everyday Americans. And so when we look at environmental decisions and we say, you know, there's going to be X amount of pollutants in the air or in the water or what have you, and then you have a conservative sort of legal project trying to dismantle that and say, no, that's not what the statute is intended to mean. Congress didn't speak clearly enough. That's Congress giving away too much of its authority. This, that, and the other thing, these things are, you know, supposed to be guided by original public meaning principles, and it's laughable to say they are. I think that that's really problematic. And so I think, you know, she and the other members of the who will likely be in the dissent on a lot of these cases, will have their work cut out for them. But again, the project of the Constitution and interpreting the Constitution is a long-term project. You're passing batons from one person to another. And I think she understands the gravity of the position she's going to be coming in and the future, hopefully, that she will be looking forward to make her impact on that.
Do you think her vote, I mean, do you think, I mean, and I don't know, I seem to remember, maybe this was 15 years ago, I saw Pam Carlin, who's a professor, a law professor out, I think, from Stanford. She, I think we last saw her on the national scene, maybe she was testifying in the run-up to the impeachment, the first impeachment. But she had said at a talk that I saw that no appointment to the Supreme Court was move the court left. For, I think at that time, like 30 or 40 years. And that may have changed, with Sotomayor. I'm not quite sure. I can't recall. But when you look at Breyer and you look at to the extent that you can tell, from Ketanji Brown Jackson, does that shift the court? To the extent that, I mean, anything's going to shift the court to the left. But that slot, does that slot become a little bit to the left?
So if I had to make a guess, and I think these sort of guesses are always sort of deadly, but if I did, I'd say maybe slightly. But we don't know. I think, you know, this is the interesting thing about a judge like Judge Jackson. She has more experience on the bench than most anybody on the bench. I believe everybody on the bench coming into the position. So we know that she thinks like she's going to come in thinking about a judge, thinking about things rigorously in a nuanced way. And in that regard, you know, it may depend on the substantive area. It may depend on the technical question. But I suspect she will be at least slightly to the left of her boss. But, you know, those predictions are difficult to make, but that's not going to change the composition or the sort of ideological shift on the whole court. This court has gone rightward, as Professor Carlin, who teaches at my alma mater, has said. That has not moved the court. We've not moved to the left. You know, the heydays of the court being to the left, the Warren era, is like far gone, and everything has shifted the court to the right since. And so these ideas that were minority decisions, laughable decisions, off-the-wall decisions and theories are now actually being given effect. And we're seeing that happen slowly but surely. And frankly, I think even faster than I thought with the term that we're in right now. So we'll see. But I think, you know, she will sort of at least help ground the liberal end of the court.
What was her corporate practice? Do you know?
She had a few years in big law. You know, and I don't, in that regard, that's not very different than most any others, but she left, which I think actually is. She left big law before becoming a justice. Like many of the judges are just plucked right out of big law. And so in that regard, I think Justice, or soon to be Justice Jackson, will look more like the current Biden nominees. Biden is picking a more diverse set of judges, more women, more people of color, more people with professional experience and backgrounds as non-prosecutors and non-partners in law firms. So in that regard, she is very different, that she didn't sort of take that straight and narrow path, or the path that was only for her own sort of her own benefit. A limited practice in big law, but, you know, practice nevertheless, but informed hopefully by the totality of her experiences as a legal professional.
I have one more question on the non-delegation doctrine. Since you're teaching it today, when you look at this, like, do you have a sense, as someone who watches the Supreme Court as intently as you do, do you have a sense of like what their plan is? Like, do, like you say breadcrumbs, but really, on many respects, it's like building blocks, right? Yeah. Or in this instance, they're building blocks to tear something down. But what do you anticipate? Do you have a notion of what path they would take? Like, in other words, here I can anticipate in this case, you know, they did this with the OSHA thing with the vaccine mandates. They didn't seem to hit on necessarily any big principle, but they weakened, they narrowed what constituted a workplace threat, right? I mean, they basically said a workplace threat has to be unique to the workplace as opposed to the idea of coming to work increasing a threat that may exist outside in society. And you know, the implications of that are pretty huge, right? Like, well, guns are dangerous outside of society, so you can't say that people just waving a gun around at workplace is dangerous, because it's dangerous if you go outside. But it's not necessarily the relationship between Congress and OSHA, let's say. What do you anticipate they're going to try and do with this case to ultimately get to that point where they sever the ability of an EPA, of an FDA, of an SEC, we could just go on and on, to use their expertise to carry out the spirit of a law that is passed by Congress?
Right. So this is the thing. I don't think it is one case in particular. I think any case that gets there that is an administrative law case, the court is going to use, at least the conservatives in the court are going to use any principle that they can pull out to actually dismantle it. And so one of the things we saw was this sort of quote unquote major questions doctrine. The idea that if there's a major issue that Congress wants a regulatory agency to tackle, they'll give them very clear and explicit authority to do that. And that sort of the broad language giving a broad discretion to an agency is not enough. Now you talk about the non-delegation doctrine, and that's the idea that Congress cannot give too much of its power or a certain portion or type of its power just to administrative agencies. And so, you know, where we need technical expertise and sort of careerists to actually guide what our everyday regulations look like, they're not going to be able to do that because Congress obviously doesn't legislate at that granular level. And so I think this is really part and parcel of a larger agenda, which is to get rid of, or at least to neuter, the administrative state, right? And so this idea that we don't need this fourth branch, if you will, actually making decisions for us and making the sort of informed decisions for us about what is helpful and useful and safe for us to live our day-to-day lives. And this has been a project for a very long time. You know, there was a case that I just taught to my students, this Gundy case. And, you know, it was basically talking about delegation and whether, you know, in a specific sex registration statute, whether Congress gave too much authority to the Attorney General. And lo and behold, you know, they didn't want to use that vehicle because we were talking about sexual people who had to register for sex crimes. But it was very clear from what the conservatives said. They basically said, you know, we need another case to actually effectuate what we want to do. That is to say, we don't want to take a sort of sex offender to be the poster boy for what we're doing to dismantle the administrative state. And so I think what they're seeing with these environmental cases and OSHA cases and any other case that comes under the ABCs of the federal government, they'll use those to employ any doctrine, whether longstanding or sort of made up in the moment, to actually dismantle the administrative agency and neuter the federal government, knowing very well that Congress doesn't pass laws and won't pass laws at that level of granularity.
We should say, when you talk about destruction of the administrative state, it was 5 years almost to the day at CPAC that Steve Bannon announced that was the agenda of the Trump administration. Three Supreme Court justices later, we are maybe not at mission accomplished, but maybe at mission accom.
And we're along in the project. That's right.
All right. Lastly, let me just ask you this question. This scenario, the nomination hearings happen over the course of the next couple of weeks, and she's nominated, she's confirmed, and 50 Senator Dianne Feinstein, or let's say Senator Patrick Leahy, he passes away or something like that, and control of the Senate goes to Mitch McConnell by hook or crook. Is she still when Breyer retires in, let's say, June or, you know, August or whenever it is she the Supreme Court justice, or can McConnell say, wait, no, we're going to have new hearings?
So this is an interesting question. I think procedurally it's going to happen in a way to avoid that outcome. Notably, there is a very young senator from New Mexico who recently had a stroke. And so the dynamic in the Senate already could have shifted in this weird way. We hope that he is getting well and then he'll be on his way to be here for this vote and other votes. But I think what's going to happen is you're going to have the Senate go through the processes and basically vote and then hold her commission until the end. And that way she will have been voted on. And if anything happens afterwards, she will still have the right, because that's when she takes the seat, is when her commission is delivered to her. So I think they're trying to avoid that.
Justices.
They can. I just don't think that they felt was that sort of imperative. Or, for example, when it was Justice... To be Justice Merrick Garland, who Ketanji Jackson actually replaced on the D.C. circuit when he became attorney general, they didn't have the votes. And so that wasn't necessary. It wasn't sort of like as closely divided. And I think, you know, having learned from those experiences, that will probably be the protocol going forward.
With Merrick Garland, they didn't control the Senate. So they couldn't, they couldn't have hearings. But I'm saying, why can't after Ketanji Brown Jackson is... confirmed by the full Senate, assuming you could get Manchin or Sinema on board. I mean, just put aside the question of the specific senators. Why can't Chuck Schumer say, you know what? Let's have another one in reserve. Someone could die. Someone could get hit by a bus. We're going to confirm two more Supreme Court justices, and they just stockpile. Like, but I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, but I don't understand what the mechanism is any different.
Yeah, and I guess there could be this world where you theoretically vote for like 9 replacements of the current justices. But I'm that I cannot answer for you. I think it's probably going to have to do with this like limitation on the number of justices that you have at any point, and that you have to have an actual recognized vacancy stated and delivered to the president before they go forward. I'm pretty sure that is exactly why they're limited.
And he's right, but is that a statute? Like, I mean, is it like we need a resignation letter before we can confirm somebody?
Yeah, well, the president can't make his nomination of the successor until there actually is a vacancy resigned to him. And so that is the sort of building block. In your world, I love your world, where the president just makes 9 appointments right now and then just has them holding into perpetuity until we get those vacancies. But there has to be an announced vacancy and an officially announced vacancy to the president before you can actually make a replacement nomination.
All right. Well, I tried. Professor,
I like your Senate.
Tell me about it.
Well, the point is, I think, like, bend the rules because Republicans have done so. And I'm not opposed to, like, that kind of thinking, obviously.
If there's a way to do it, I think we should be doing it. Yeah. Wilfred Codrington, Assistant Professor of Law at Brooklyn Law School, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam and Emma. Nice being with you.
Yes, thank you.
All right, folks. First day back, went long in the fun in the free half.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. Knew that was coming.
Something tells me we're going to be going long in the fun half too.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Huh.
Folks, I've got some bad news.
What?
I got some bad news and I got some good news. The bad news is the Brooklyn show has sold out. Yep. Yeah. I mean, that's good news for us.
My final,
but it's bad news for you.
Did it.
We sold out the Brooklyn show sometime last week. And I knew we would. I knew we would. The good news is still seats for the Boston show. The Boston venue is 3 times the size as the Brooklyn venue. I think in Brooklyn, it's like 350 seats. In Boston, it's like 1,000 and something. Well, maybe that's, 3 times. Yeah, exactly. And so you can still get tickets to go see the Boston show. The Boston show is going to be much better.
Okay.
I'm joking. I'm joking. But you go to majoritylive.com, you get tickets to the Boston show.
There are like a million different like special guests in the Boston show.
The Boston show could be just epic. And then the Brooklyn show is going to be super fun. But Boston show is going to be, what? Seriously?
So the point is that there's truth in your joke.
Maybe.
Huh. All right.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe the Brooklyn show is better than the Boston show. But we may also have something going on with the Brooklyn show. I'm going to talk about that later.
Oh, okay.
But, folks.
Trying to get Kyrie Irving.
It is. Well, after they get rid of the vaccine mandate, we could do that.
Soon enough, right? Adam says any moment now.
Folks, just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Honestly, members these days are making up something like 92.3% of our revenue. I made up that number.
Okay.
I can't do that math. But it's our members that make it possible for us to do this show. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, tomorrow I'm going to be more explicit about this. But I think we got something cooking. Get your AM Quickie subscription now.
Whoa.
And you can get it for free at amquickie.com. You know, Jack Crosby, who you had on last week, one of the writers of the AM Quickie, I saw him on MSNBC this weekend.
Wow.
He was in a garage in, he's not in Kyiv. He's in the, I think in the second or where?
He's in Kharkiv.
Kharkiv. Yeah. And I think they've made him a contributor for the, for his
good.
Kharkiv
is, you know, right now the one of the hearts of the fighting right now.
Yeah. Apparently they're just dropping cluster bombs down there. So, hopefully, Jack is safe. Maybe we're going to get a chance to, talk to him again this week. In the meantime, Corey is holding down the fort on the AM Quickie. So check that out. Corey's in touch with Jack. And hopefully he's safe. But go and you can subscribe to the AM Quickie by going to amquickie.com, putting your email in there. And we will never sell your email address to anybody. So there's that. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Did you do the Just Coffee pictures?
I did. I should write it down because it's like not, for some reason, it doesn't stick in my memory in the way.
Oh my God, it is imprinted on my brain. It's
I
the
know.
Only thing I've been saying for 10 years.
Right. Well, I it's getting
12. They started sponsoring Break Room Live.
Wow.
14 years.
Well, I do love their coffee.
Justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, you get 10% off. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media empire?
We had a really excellent guest for on Left Reckoning Patrons yesterday. Mark Kruger, who wrote the book The St. Louis Commune of 1877, it talks about how on the occasion of the 1877 Great Rail Strike, that there's a bunch of German Marxists and also anarchists and a whole bunch of radicals. 60% of St. Louis was foreign born at the time, and they took the Great Rail Strike as an opportunity to take over the entire city of St. Louis for like 5 days or so. So we talked about that. A pretty incredible little slice of history. A lot of
like the Jacobins.
It was like Jacobins, but it also like it was cross racial. A whole bunch of like different types of immigrants and black folks there. And it was like, you know, Marx inspired. And there's a lot of like red baiting there too, because the Paris Commune was a few years before. And then you also had the 1848 revolutions, which is what inspired a lot of the sort of German, particularly immigrants that showed up in St. Louis. So a radical history that I was unaware of. And
I'm completely unaware of that.
And it also goes into my favorite sort of like, you know, we all have our different obsessions with Reconstruction. And my thing is how the Union and Confederate sort of like military came together in part in North Dakota to like take a to go to war with the Sioux, Lakota. But in this case, it was like, let's come together to put down a workers' strike. And
there you go. It's nice to bring people together. It's always nice to do that.
So Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get that interview.
Check that out. That is one I'm definitely.
You should get him on here, actually.
Yeah, I would like to do that. It sounded so fascinating. I saw it on Twitter last night when I was coming out of my post-Disney stupor. We took a We had to get up at 4 a.m.
Jeez.
Friday morning. And I got news for you. Like,
to fly back?
Yeah. Well, we took a 7 a.m. flight because it was the only flight I could get.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, like, Saul and I were sharing a bed, and it was like a small bed, and, you know, I had to put pillows in between us because he kicks.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, it's going to take me like a week to get over
vacation
the,
from your vacation.
No kidding. No kidding. Folks, see you in the fun half. 646-257-3920. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What?
What is that going on? It's nuts. Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt!
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it! Let's go, Brandon!
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today!
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop. Talking oh, for wow. a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
Lemonade?
Yes.
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go tell that.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though. Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
We call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about yeah. you is just like every day, all day, like yeah. everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
folks.
Love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.